WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Jennifer Glass, and this is On Point. Fasten your seatbelts. The driverless car is here. Google will be rolling out a fleet of 20,000 taxis without drivers in Phoenix this year. Tesla says it will have a car drive itself from Los Angeles to New York. And some experts say we'll all be handing over the wheel in the next few years. But in the wake of two driverless car fatalities, some wonder if we're skidding off the road too fast. This hour on Point, the future of self-driving cars. But first, we turn to the EPA's announcement that it's revoking Obama-era auto emission standards, saying that the 50 miles per gallon requirement by 2025 was too high. California is threatening to sue. With 12 other states following California's lead, get ready for major political and legal battles. We reached out to the EPA. They didn't respond to our request to participate or provide a statement. Joining me now from Washington is Carolyn Lockhead, Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. Her story yesterday was headlined, Trump's EPA moves to roll back emissions rules for cars, trucks. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Carolyn, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jennifer.
So thanks for being here. Mike, what did the EPA do yesterday?
Well, the EPA basically said it made a final ruling that it's going to reexamine these car standards and in all likelihood weaken them. In fact, they pretty much said they're going to weaken them. They're too tough on automakers. This is probably Administrator Scott Pruitt's biggest action on the climate change front, because transportation makes up the majority now of greenhouse gas emissions. This is bigger than the climate plan or anything else, because cars are such a big chunk of our emissions.
And California, under the Clean Air Act, actually has a waiver to set its own emission standards, and that's something that Scott Pruitt is looking at as well. So this really sets up a conflict with California, doesn't it?
Not just a conflict. This is going to be a monumental legal fight, because these clean car standards, California is definitely moving ahead on clean car standards. In fact, it's going to tighten them further. There is no way that California can meet its ambitious greenhouse gas targets without them. So every state official from the governor on down, the attorney general, the head of the California Air Resources Board said, no way are we turning back on this. So we've got a huge conflict now with the potential for a double standard that automakers will have to sell some cars in Oklahoma and different cars in California.
The attorney general, very strong words this week, saying we're going to do everything that can be done to defend these standards. So far, when we've been challenged on environmental standards, we've had a good record in court, he says. Now, let's listen to Scott Pruitt testifying before the Senate Environment and Public Works Oversight Committee on January 3rd of this year, saying that the EPA may do away with the waivers, along with states like California, to implement stronger emission standards.
Federalism doesn't mean that one state can dictate to the rest of the country, but we recognize California's special status in the statute, and we are working with them to find a consensus around these issues.
But it looks like no consensus moving forward. And as you said, Carolyn, what do we think this legal battle is going to look like?
Well, I don't see either side budging. And in order to stick with one national standard, which Pruitt and the automakers say they want, California would have to relax its standards, or the EPA would have to not roll them back. So it's a real Donnybrook. I don't see any room for compromise at this point. Some of the automakers want is for the two sides to finesse things, give them a range of credits and so forth that would make it easier for them to meet these rules. But it was interesting to me that American Honda told me that all the automakers know that we need to go to electrified powertrains. The rest of the world is moving toward electric vehicles. Some of the automakers still want to make a lot of SUVs and pickup trucks. That's what's selling now with low gas prices, but that is not the future of automobiles.
Wow, so a whole different movement. Electric vehicles would mean a whole different thing. I want to bring in a little bit of the environmental impact of this. You mentioned it earlier. Joining us from Washington is Daniel Becker. He's the director of the Safe Climate Campaign, which fights global warming, and he's the former director of the Sierra Club's Global Warming Program. Daniel, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Daniel, tell us, as Carolyn alluded to, cars, transportation are the biggest polluter in the United States. What will this rollback mean for the environment?
Well, it's a huge gift to polluters, and it's a cynical effort to make America polluted again, to coin a phrase. These standards are the biggest single step, as Carolyn said, to curbing global warming and saving oil. They'll save 12 billion barrels of oil and 6 million tons of carbon dioxide pollution while saving consumers about $1 trillion at the gas pump net of the cost of the technologies that improve the mileage and emissions. So this is a huge environmental benefit that the administration wants to now attack. And they're doing it at the behest of the auto companies. It was a year ago, January, that the then CEO of Ford Motor Company turned to the president in a meeting 4 days into the new administration and said, you've got to roll back these terrible CAFE standards or we'll lose 1 million jobs in the auto industry, which was an alternative fact. If you add Ford's and GM's and Chrysler's total number of employees, it's only 900,000. So they were making stuff up. And
Daniel, on those CAFE standards, can you explain those for our listeners?
Sure. What this was a negotiated agreement between the auto companies, the administration, California, and the other states that follow California's law and environmentalists. Partly it was in exchange for the $85 billion bailout that the taxpayers gave GM and Chrysler. And what the rules require is that the fleet on average needs to achieve better fuel economy. So you save gasoline mostly by adding better technology to the vehicle, better engines, better transmissions, improved aerodynamics. There's no requirement in these rules that they make a single electric vehicle, and some of the car companies aren't making a single electric vehicle. But what Mr. Pruitt is alleging is that these standards are bad for the auto companies that had previously agreed to them, and the auto companies are enthusiastically greeting rollbacks, although they're a little bit worried that Trump wants to go too far and go to war with California and the other states that want cleaner vehicles so that they can protect their citizens' health and environment.
Carolyn said that that she's spoken to car companies that want to make electric cars. Are you not finding that?
They want to make a few electric cars. Ford Motor Company says it wants to make 20 different models of electric cars, but last year they only made 1,817 actual electric cars. It's like the wimpy character in Popeye. I gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. They claim that they want something that they're not actually trying to do. Other than a few companies like Tesla that really want to make electric cars, Nissan's making a fair number. GM is making a fair number of one type, the Bolt, but nothing near the 750,000 pickup trucks, F-150 pickup trucks, for example, that Ford makes every year. Electric cars are absolutely the future, but the auto companies want them to be the distant future.
Carolyn, sorry to interrupt you there. Carolyn, I just wanted to come back to you on what you think Californians can do, California can do, and how long will this debate take? Daniel, obviously not happy and feeling that it's going to have a huge environmental impact. California, famous for its environmental regulation. Is there anything that Californians can do?
Well, Californians can stop buying pickup trucks and SUVs, which are now the most popular vehicle in California. But what California will do is fight this. It really does, though, damage its ability to meet its own clean car standards, because you get big economies of scale under a national standard where all the automakers are required to meet a specific standard. Now it's just California and 12 other states, and although that's a third of the market, that's still not as big a market, and it's going to slow down that whole process. But the legal fight poses a threat to the auto companies, too, because this could easily go into the next administration, and they've got to get their vehicle designs out for the model years in question. So this isn't necessarily, is probably throwing a wrench into their own designs, which is why they are all hankering for a single national standard, even though they want it lowered.
So an environmental as well as an economic impact. Daniel, do you get a sense from the car companies that they feel like they have any environmental responsibility?
No, but they know that their customers care about the environment, and they don't want to stick their fingers in their customers' eyes. That's what they're effectively doing by demanding these rollbacks. But they also need to be worried about China, because the Chinese are building an enormous auto industry that has its eyes on American consumers, too. And if the American manufacturers take advantage of Mr. Trump's action and Pruitt's action to get out of the business of making vehicles with cleaner technology, the Chinese may very well step in and take away that market share. So it's an existential threat to the auto companies. And they also are heading back on the path that they were in 2008, when they made so many SUVs and so many pickup trucks, and when the gas prices started to rise, consumers didn't want them. And I don't know when gas prices will start to go back up, but we all know that they will someday, and the auto companies could be caught with their tailpipes down if that happens.
So, Carolyn, just very briefly, this rollback by the EPA didn't come entirely as a surprise.
No, Pruitt signaled this way back at a Senate confirmation hearing when he was directly asked by Senator Kamala Harris about the waiver, and he was, he wasn't definitive about it. It would be a very big legal challenge to overturn that waiver. It's written into the 1970 Clean Air Act.
Carolyn Lockhead, who's the Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Daniel Becker, the director of the Safe Climate Change Campaign, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And when we come back, we'll turn to self-driving cars. You can join the conversation. Would you be willing to give up the wheel to a machine? I'm Jennifer Glass. This is On Point.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Glass. We're talking about driverless cars. In the wake of two fatalities, you can join the conversation. Is it time to put the brakes on self-driving cars? Are you ready to keep putting the pedal to the metal? Even with these two deaths, are they safer than cars driven by humans? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from San Francisco is Tim Higgins, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal who covers tech and autos. His story yesterday was headlined, Tesla, Uber Deaths. Uber Deaths raise questions about the perils of partly autonomous drivings. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining me, Tim.
Thank you.
Tim, tell me where we are right now with driverless cars. I think many people think it's still far in the future.
There are two paths here. Right now, we have a company named Waymo, which used to be part of Google's R&D effort to create self-driving cars. And they are currently in Phoenix testing vehicles that do not need humans behind the wheel. I've been in one of these cars on a test track. It is an exciting experience to be sitting in the back seat and watch the wheel move about. And so they are pushing to have a commercial service, a robot taxi fleet by the end of this year. That's one route. The other route is that these vehicles are not being sold to consumers. And so what car companies are doing are selling cars to you and I that have increasingly automated safety features, such as essentially think of it as super cruise control, where it can control the speed on the highway, it can get a speed behind a vehicle, it can help you keep within a lane. Eventually, we see that these kind of features will become more advanced, and you might be able to push a button and go on the highway and it'll handle things while you look at your email or something like that. That's the near future, according to the automakers.
So car companies, little by little, are getting drivers used to these features, putting the car back in the lane, stopping the car so that eventually they could go on to driverless cars. But already at Tesla, for example, its autopilot feature has had a number of glitches, a number of problems.
Right. Tesla's autopilot system is not a self-driving feature. It's one of these semi-autonomous features. And we've seen some incidents. In 2016, a man driving his Tesla Model S in Florida crashed into a truck crossing the highway, and he died. And the federal regulators investigated it, and they said, well, the system wasn't defective. And then the National Transportation Safety Board came in and said, well, Tesla was partially to blame here for a couple of reasons. It allowed him to keep his hands off the wheel for a long period of time, and it also allowed him to use the system in areas on roads that it wasn't really designed to be able to handle. And there's some concerns about it.
And the question is, whose fault is that? And then the last month or so, we've seen two fatalities, one in Mountain View, California, with a Tesla crashing into a barrier, and another 5 days before in Tempe, Arizona, when a pedestrian was killed.
Yeah, that the Tempe crash involved an Uber. Now, this is a test vehicle that's aiming to try to get to be self-driving like Waymo, where you wouldn't need to have a driver behind the wheel at all. And as they test that, they have a safety operator behind the wheel, a person who is supposed to be at guard to take control of the wheel at any moment in case the computer can't handle the situation or in case there's some safety concerns. So these two crashes just a few days apart underscore this challenge that researchers and experts say exists in this partial autonomy world. And that is that the human is there, the computer seems to be doing everything, but the human has to keep vigilance to grab the wheel in case it doesn't work. Essentially, a system that says it'll be able to handle things until it can't, and you just don't maybe necessarily know when it can't. And we as humans are very bad at this kind of task because, I mean, just think about driving on a highway with a normal car. Your mind begins to wander. Take away the idea of having to keep your hands on it or your foot on the gas pedal, and all of a sudden your mind wanders even more and more. And over large periods of time, maybe you become more and more confident in this technology, and you become overconfident, and you think it can do more than it actually can. And that is what experts say is really when it becomes dangerous to the driver.
So many questions raised by this, and our lines are really lighting up. We're going to go to Bob. He's calling from here in Boston. Bob, thanks for calling on Point.
Yes, hi. Tim just touched on something. And hi, Jennifer. Thank you for a great forum for this incredibly important topic. Tim has not yet made the point that I was going to make, but he was talking about vigilance.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about responsibility in class action lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you take, there's a learning curve to this. Someday we are going to be the Jetsons, but at what cost? And with texting, social media, things like this, people will be inclined not to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
They're GPSed in. They expect the car to get them there safely. We might as well just take the steering wheel out because they're not paying attention. I'm not talking about the couple of fatalities that just came up. I'm talking about class action lawsuits driven by, you know, any machine can break. The only computer that belongs in a car is the human brain. We started this decades ago with automatic transmissions because we took one of the skill sets out of driving, a manual transmission.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've taken the skill set out of parallel parking, which when I was a kid was required just to get a simple driver's license.
And thanks. Well, Bob, you make a really important point that little by little you take the skills of driving away. And what happens? What happens in a generation or half a generation when people don't know how to drive cars? Thank you so much for calling in, Bob. From Nashville, Tennessee, John, you're on the air.
Hey, Jennifer. My wife and I recently bought two cars for our growing family over the last 3 years, and we bought them with the express idea that the next car we would get would be electric, and it would hopefully be self-driving. And so we bought cars that have like a long track record and long engine life, but then the eventual goal is to get rid of the active driving because it is dangerous. It is a very large, unwieldy, battering ram that you're moving down the highway.
Mm-hmm.
And these two unfortunate sort of fatalities, it sounds as though the one was a pedestrian, and it's not entirely sure whether or not it was the driver was at fault, that was like the safety driver. And then with Tesla and I think it was the driver who was, I think, was like watching a DVD or something like that when the crash happened. It's obviously like there's this learning curve, but those two deaths are much, much smaller when you compare it to just the sort of horrible fatalities that happen every day due to distracted driving. And when you take away the, you know, humans are pretty terrible at driving. When you think about, like, you know, the total number of fatalities and accidents that occur every single day. And I think we need to remove this sort of action from transportation. And I'm looking forward to it because I was, you know, driving just a few hours over the weekend for Easter going home, and I had an incident in the backseat of my wife with me. And it's very distracting to be able to move safely up and down the road. So I, for one, am really looking forward to a self-driving future. I mean, we don't have elevator operators anymore. There's not a whole lot of reason to have car operators as soon as the technology is valid. Thank you.
Thanks so much, John. Tim, what do you think of that?
Well, here's an interesting thing. When Google started developing its self-driving car technology years ago, they've been working on this for almost a decade, and seen by analysts and experts as probably the furthest along. They thought about having a partial autonomy system, and they started testing it on roads with employees and said, hey, listen, You still need to monitor this system. It's going to drive itself down the highway. It's going to drive you to work, but you got to pay attention in case it doesn't work. And we have cameras in the car, and we're going to be monitoring everything. Well, they very quickly discovered that even their own employees couldn't remain vigilant. They started seeing videos of people, a woman putting makeup on, or people just zoning out, and including one guy who fell asleep. And and Google immediately scrapped that program and made a large strategic decision to pivot away from this idea of partial autonomy, because they felt that it just was never going to work, and they needed to focus on pulling the human out of being behind the wheel and make a driverless system. So that's a path that they have taken. And time will tell if their competitors can do partial autonomy.
Right now we're just about halfway there, and it's had some problems. I want to bring in a few more voices. Joining us from New York now is Hod Lipson. He's a professor of mechanical engineering at Columbia University, and he's the director of the Creative Machines Lab. He's also the author of Driverless: Intelligent Cars and the Road Ahead, out last year. Hod, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
Also joining us from San Francisco is Mary Cummings, a professor of mechanical engineering at the Duke University Pratt School of Engineering and director of the Humans and Autonomy Lab, where she focuses on human-manned vehicle interaction and public policy implications of unmanned vehicles. Thanks for joining us, Mary.
Thanks for having me.
So a lot of issues here, ethics issues, regulatory issues. Hod, let me start with you. What do driverless vehicles bring for us in the future? What do we need to be watching, and what needs to happen?
Well, I think there are multiple advantages when it comes to driverless cars. Primarily, the issue of safety. And I know we're going through a sort of a transition period right now, where cars are almost there. They're not quite. There's tragedies that happen here and there, but. By and large, if you take the long view, these cars are going to save lives. And we're not talking about a few lives. We're talking over a million lives per year. There are 1.2 million fatalities around the world, and this is coming. But beyond that, we're looking at completely new modes of economy. We will see a ripple effect on the environment, on real estate, on e-commerce. I mean, this is a major change that's coming our way.
Mary?
Well, I agree in principle that these cars will eventually save lives, but I think that the time scale that people are hearing about in the press is very misleading. We are not going to have fully autonomous cars that you can jump in your back seat and go to sleep and tell it to take you to San Francisco across country drive. That's not coming for 20 or more years. So I think what people need to understand is we're still in the very early stages of the development of this technology, and one of the things that we're really lacking is principled testing, and that is actually one of the, I think, the things that you're going to be seeing happening in the next few months, few years, are trying to figure out a way to ensure that these technologies truly are safe. We just can't take Google, Waymo, Uber at their word.
Tim, Mary's challenging your timeline. You're saying there's going to be autonomous taxis out there by the end of the year. She says it's going to take a lot longer than that.
Well, I think that what we need to talk about is deployment and what it looks like. What she's saying, this idea of being able to go coast to coast or even across a state or outside of a town, doesn't seem likely in the next couple of years, given just even what the companies are talking about. But where the issue and where the focus on deployment is in confined areas. So Waymo, for example, is driving around in a suburb of Phoenix. And really going street to street, cul-de-sac to cul-de-sac, and in a way that is not is going to take long periods of time just to do that across the country. So what we're talking about is probably not as sexy or as Jetson age-like as some people might imagine. We're not talking about Knight Rider here. We're talking about almost a controlled rollout by a company that has put a lot of time into knowing the community. That's not being able to buy a self-driving car. It's about buying the mileage, about buying the trip. So we see that in the next couple of years, perhaps. She brings up this other point that is that we hear a lot, is that there has this technology hasn't been validated yet, and regulators and consumers aren't quite sure about it yet.
We're going to go to the phones. This is a very, very topic that's got our callers in. Ray is calling from Tampa, Florida. Ray, you're on point.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi there.
I just bought a 2018 Tahoe, and to my surprise, I wouldn't say it's autonomous, but it's definitely a early warning system that it has in it. Like it's got lane recognition and proximity as far as when you're following too closely to a vehicle in front of you. But I gently was, I kind of veered off the lane a little bit or towards the lane line. And it gently vibrated my seat and veered me back into the lane. And I thought something was wrong with my car at first. But once I got used to it, it's actually very beneficial. Now, I don't feel like it's taking anything from my driving technique or anything like that. I'm still alert. But it has alerted me when it recognizes brake lights. But my foot is still on the gas. And it has a light that flashes and my seat vibrates to let me know, hey, these vehicles are stopping in front of you.
So your car is training you. The technology moving forward, and of course, as it moves forward, it raises a lot of questions. So when an autonomous car, when we finally have self-driving cars, or even when the car takes over from you, as Ray was just saying, his car moves him back into the lane or brakes for him, what kind of ethics questions does this have? When a car hits somebody, who's in charge? And eventually, as they start programming these cars, they're going to have to tell this computer to decide what decisions to make. Do you save the people in the car? Do you hit somebody on the road? A lot of ethics decisions coming up. Tim, has that even been discussed anywhere?
Yeah, it is increasingly being discussed. It's the first time probably in many generations where the idea of corporations putting robots, this idea of robots on the street that have to make decisions that are human-like, you can probably fill books of philosophy on these sorts of things, and it's great cocktail chatter. But I think one of the things we're seeing right now is that these vehicles on the road aren't making robot decisions. They're really, think of it more as less automated and more it's not as complex as the robot. So if the sensor can't see something, it's not going to stop, and the human has to keep in control, and that's hard for the human driver to remember. They don't necessarily understand what the system can and cannot see. When that fatal crash occurred in Florida in 2016 with the Model S, Tesla said it occurred because the vehicle couldn't see the truck against the white sky. That's a limitation that the driver probably didn't know about.
Tim, thanks so much for that. Tim, Hod, and Mary, please stay with us. We're discussing self-driving cars, and we'll be back. I'm Jennifer Glass, and this is On Point.
NPR's Code Switch tackles race and identity in America with humanity and humor. You'll laugh, you'll learn, you'll get uncomfortable. It's worth it. Find Code Switch on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Glass. We're talking about the reality of driverless cars. You can join the conversation. Do you already have a high-tech car? Are you ready for a car that takes over completely? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking to Tim Higgins, tech and auto reporter for The Wall Street Journal, Hod Lipson, professor of mechanical engineering at Columbia University, director of the Creative Machines Lab, and Mary Cummings, professor of mechanical engineering in the Duke University Pratt School of Engineering, and a director of the Humans and Autonomy Lab. But first, I want to hear from the companies. They think that this is all right and that moving forward is okay, especially after that fatal accident involving an Uber driverless car in Arizona last month. Waymo CEO John Kravchik told CNN that he has complete faith in his own company's technology and that they are building, quote, the world's most experienced driver.
1.25 million people die every year. It's like a 737 crashing every hour of every day. And I think we all agree as global citizens, that's terrible. Like, it's amazing we have been okay with that. We think there is a better way, and we think the world does deserve the opportunity for technology like Waymo's technology to have a shot at doing a better job of getting us around.
We're going to hear from some of our listeners now. This has been a very emotive subject. Shane is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Shane, you're on the air.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi there.
Hi, yeah, my original point was kind of just taken there, but I have another one where I'm 30 years old and I really don't love owning the car. I need one for work, but I think people, sort of younger people, don't really like buying cars. Most of our friends don't, own cars because of the expense with insurance and repairs. So I think if we can get to a point where you can order a car, just pulls up and takes you places. We're already sort of seeing that with Uber and Lyft, but if it was even easier where there was a subscription model or something, I think that younger people would really be drawn to the driverless car sort of situation. So,
thanks, Shane. Good point there. Jamie is calling from Charleston, South Carolina.
Hey, good. Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I was an Uber driver back in Charlotte, North Carolina for 10 months, and I had somebody in my car at one point who told me that he had worked on some of these driverless cars. And part of the problem was that if you rolled a ball in front of one of these driverless cars, it wasn't going to pick it up. But it's not the ball that's the problem. It's the child running after it. And the bigger problem, in my estimation, is that we are jumping the gun, so to speak. I really believe that what we need to do is we need to have every car to have a rear view camera. Every car needs to have that braking. Every car needs to have all the things that some of these things that this man who just bought that 2018 truck has. Every car needs to have one of those things, and I think then and only then will we be able to get to a point where we can have driverless cars because the technology will truly catch up. But I don't believe that having it by the end of this year is going to be a good thing, because it's when somebody hits a child, when one of those driverless cars hits a child or children, mm-hmm. and it really bothers me that it's in the suburbs of Phoenix, not in an urban area where mm-hmm. you would have less likely of a problem with a child running out into the road. I think that's when people are going to finally wake up and go, okay, we need to work on this a little bit more before we actually put this out there.
Jamie, thanks so much for calling. Mary, are we jumping the gun? Is it too soon?
Well, I've been very vocal on this point. I do think it's too soon to be testing these cars on public roads without any evidence from the manufacturers and the developers that these cars are indeed safe. Waymo has sponsored some of my research. I definitely appreciate the work that they've been doing. However, they released a safety report in the fall of last year that was content-free and actually had no data in it at all to show that they had done any testing to look at these what we call edge cases. But I would tell you, even the case of the Uber pedestrian, that was not an edge case. That was a case that should have been that's a softball case mm-hmm. for driverless cars. And so I do think that the companies should be forced to show test data to the local municipalities where they're testing, so that the local governments can make an informed decision about whether or not these cars are truly safe.
What about that, Hod? Do we have enough information? Is the regulation out there?
I think that, I agree with Mayor here. There's somewhat of a lack of transparency in the performance of these vehicles. And what I do think they're coming a lot sooner than we expect. They're moving forward fast. They're going to save a lot of lives even when they're not perfect. But really, we need to have some data. We need to have transparency around performance. Ideally, we'd have some kind of rating system, just like you have miles per gallon. You have horsepower. You would have another rating that say, how does this car perform compared to an average human driver? And then people can make decisions on their own. Do they want to get something that's twice as safe, 10 times as safe? There could be legislation that you can't put a car until you convince some authority that your car is safe, just like you can't put a drug on the market before you convince the FDA. So we need some kind of transparency. But there's one point I think that we have to take into account, especially when it comes to these edge cases, is that these cars get better the more they train. Unlike humans that have a sort of constant performance over the years, the more cars there are on the road, the better each one of them gets. So it's sort of an exponential rate of improvement. This is why it's so hard to predict. Mm-hmm. This is why it's going to come sooner. But we got to get on that curve sooner rather than later. And it is as tragic as every incident happens. As many have said, there are thousands of these fatalities every day that don't even make it to the local news. So we really need to get there soon. And the only way these cars can train is if they are on public roads. There's a limit to how much you can test in the lab, in mock cities, and so forth.
So you have to get out there. 37,000 vehicle deaths a year in the United States. From Santa Fe, New Mexico, Michael is on the line. Michael, thanks for calling On Point.
Hello, Jennifer. I think we will probably see self-driving trucks first, cross-country, because they can drive 24 hours, stopping only for gas, which the trucking companies will not need drivers. And secondly, they only need to drive terminal to terminal. Then a human driver can take it the last mile through the city streets. So I think that the self-driving trucks are going to come first. Your comments?
Thanks, Michael. Tim? Self-driving trucks soon?
Well, that's work that's underway. And we look at the deployment of this technology, and there's kind of some buckets that we see the companies working on. Robot taxis is a popular one because the equipment that will be on these vehicles is so expensive that you really need to have the vehicle in operation on a constant basis. And also you need to have the technical expertise to kind of maintain it because it's very complex at this point. And another bucket would be this idea of freight traffic that could handle highways and go distances. It's a set route. The challenge is for all this, though, it gets into the details. Highway driving might be easier, but what do you do when you have to get off the highway? What do you have to do when you have to navigate the town or navigate the parking lot? These are things that the developers are struggling with, and they're coming up with some ideas on how they might do it. But it's still unsettling to some to think about a huge truck hurling down the highway without a person in it. And you then raise also some political questions about what about this employment base of truck drivers across the country?
Of course, driverless cars and jobs, that's a huge issue. What will happen to all those taxi drivers and Uber drivers? And you talked about road conditions, Tim. From our website, Dev says without perfect roads and proper demarcations, self-driving cars might be no less hazardous than regular manual drivers. Do American towns and cities have the money to fix the roads? As we know, a lot of our infrastructure not in great shape. Anne is calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Anne?
Yes. Hi, Jennifer. Yeah, what about winter? Much of our country has significant winters, especially here in the Northeast, and I just can't imagine that these vehicles can handle blizzard conditions on the highway, which people have to commute in all the time. You know, driving their cars on these blizzard roads full of snow. The snowplows can't even keep up much of the time. And what are people going to do? We have to have a separate car for those conditions that we drive ourselves, because I can't imagine these self-driving cars with other cameras and gizmos are going to be able to understand the huge variation in winter conditions that they can encounter.
Thank you, Anne. It's a great question. White snow, black ice, can these cars navigate that? We know that accident in 2016 was a white truck that the sensors didn't see. Hod, what do you think?
It's all a matter of training. So right now, these cars are being trained in the sort of easier climate, so to speak. That's sort of the first target. But once these cars are trained in snow condition, in rain, in fog, they will do just as well and even better than humans. It's also hard for humans to drive in these conditions. So sort of the bar is low, so to speak. But cars can learn. It's just a matter of training. There have been some studies looking at how machines can recognize objects on the road in rain and fog. And again, they outperform humans in those conditions. So I think so I'm very optimistic about that, but it hasn't been a priority right now for automotive companies to train their cars in those conditions. But as the technology moves forward, this, you know, growing the market will be a big piece of how this will grow.
Tim, I wanted to ask, because computers are involved, do we need to worry about hacking?
That's definitely part of the conversation. We always need to worry about security with these pieces of technology. One of the things that we hear about this is that this kind of this concern or excitement that the world will change overnight when this technology rolls out. And one of the things that I talk to a lot of people about is this idea of look at the iPhone. It does so many interesting things, so many wild and exciting things that a generation ago we never would have anticipated. But when Apple first came out with Apple Newton, it wasn't very exciting. The technology wasn't quite there. The society wasn't quite there yet. And there is a school of thought that perhaps the first generation of fully self-driving cars might not be as exciting as everybody thinks it will be. It'll be much more pedestrian in many ways and more like shuttles that go around in boring little areas as we learn and grow and figure out how to do this technology at scale.
Kenneth is calling us from Columbus, Georgia. Kenneth?
Hi, Jennifer. I want to come at you from a different perspective. I've been legally blind since birth and can't drive, haven't driven. In fact, my mom asked the doctor one time, said, can he drive? Doctor said, yes, just let me know when he does. I'll stay home that day. But, you know, to always depend on somebody else, because when they pick you up, sometimes they're late, or if you're riding home with somebody, you know, you can't get home when you want to get home. And the public transportation, it takes me an hour and 15 minutes to get to a place that takes 7 minutes by car.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, what about those millions of us who, I'll take the chance.
So the future can't come fast enough for you. Thanks, Kenneth, so much. Stefan is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks for calling On Point, Stefan.
Hi, Jennifer. I just wanted to comment from the other side of the fence. I'm one of those people, and maybe Charlotte's not a huge city, but it's still a big city. But I would never want one of these things simply because, like, I enjoy driving my vehicles. I enjoy going to the car lot and looking at trucks and cars. And like, I would never want to give that enjoyment up of a self-driving car. And I know I'm not the only person that thinks that way. We talk about stuff like this, and we just laugh. And they're like, who would ever want one of these things? The only place I could ever see them being, like, a demand for them would be, like, bigger cities, like New York City and Chicago or Seattle, where people do take cabs and stuff, or live downtown areas, and they just take cabs away. But most Americans, we enjoy driving our cars. It's a freedom. It's a privilege that we enjoy doing. So I don't understand why all this money is being poured into that technology when I don't see a huge return coming on the investment. I just really don't.
Well, thanks very much, Stefan. Of course, there are arguments about safety, but what happens when you have these self-driving cars? How do you get people off the roads? Are you going to have self-driving cars alongside regular drivers, manual drivers? Are we going to have the same kind of problems? Mary?
So there's been a lot of talk about what the future will look like once driverless cars become the majority on the road instead of the minority. I don't think that's going to happen for a long time. I do think that one day, though, when we get there, the urban environments and, you know, cities like London are already talking about this, where, you know, unless you're in a driverless car, you are not going to allow access to certain high congested areas.
But you know, looking far into the future, people are already thinking about driving national parks, for example. So instead of going to Yellowstone, there'll be special parks set aside with nice windy roads just so you can take the rare car that can be human driven, and so you can experience the thrill of driving. And so I do think that it's not that the driverless car community has ignored the fact that there are people who really do love to drive their car, and that is why cars will not be replaced, at least outright, for the foreseeable future. But there is going to be a time where it's going to be considered a luxury, and in another 100 years, children will just be aghast that people ever drove.
Wow. Is that the future we're looking at, Tim?
It very well could be. That's the push at this point. The idea that you would have a car, it would be like maybe having a horse today. It'd be a rarity. We'll have to see. I mean, even look at Waymo. They just announced that they're going to acquire as many as 20,000 Jaguar SUVs for their robot taxi fleet in just a couple years. 20,000 doesn't sound like a lot, but research has shown or has suggested that a community with 750 people in a square mile is kind of perfect for a robot taxi fleet. And if you can capture 15% of the miles traveled there you could really service that community and cut down on the number of vehicles that are owned.
That's Tim Higgins. He's the tech and auto reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Tim, thanks so much for being on Point.
Thank you.
And Hod Libson, a professor of mechanical engineering at Columbia University, the director of the Creative Machines Lab, and the author of Driverless, Intelligent Cars and the Road Ahead. Hod, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mary Cummings, professor of mechanical engineering in the Duke University Pratt School of Engineering and director of the Humans and Autonomy Lab. Thanks for being on with us.
Thanks, Jennifer.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jennifer Glass, and this is On Point.